So good evening. So tonight we turn toward equanimity, the last of the paramis. So it's part of this year-long course that Tuari and I have been exploring. And next month we'll explore kind of a summary of them all, and then Tuari will take that into how do you live the paramis. So equanimity comes on the heels of loving kindness. So this is an essential part of our practice. It's a very important way of how we relate to experience, how we relate to our own inner life, as well as externally. Taking some definitions from the dictionary, mental calmness, composure, and evenness of temper, especially in a difficult situation. She accepted both the good and the bad with equanimity. Composure, calm, level-headedness, self-possession, cool-headedness, presence of mind. So see, these are some of the ways that we define equanimity in the English language. It's really relating to life from a balanced place, not caught in craving or aversion, in a place of balance. Yet, this word equanimity, we have to treat a little carefully. Because if we just take those definitions of being cool and level-headed, self-possessed, if we're not careful, there's a distortion that can kind of slip in and change how we're holding that word. And this really centers around this tendency as humans that we have to avoid pain, to avoid discomfort, to move away. And this is very much a instinctual part of our beings. I mean, our ancestors, all the way back to the single-celled organisms, would move away from noxious things. There's this movement away from what's painful, from what hurts. So it's really very much into our cells. So it's important to honor that as a protective mechanism, as something that serves us. At the same time, this fundamental instinct also has limitations. It has many limitations, because if we always ran away from the difficult, it would be very hard to be in a relationship. The very time my wife did something I didn't like and I ran away, I wouldn't be married for very long. So there's that sense of willingness to meet whatever arises. Luckily, she doesn't do that very often. So we think of equanimity sometimes as being opposite of that reactivity, that moving away, that sense of being lost in anger and fear and sadness. To be equanimous is the opposite of that, is the way that our minds tend to take this. The opposite of the very pain that instinctually we want to avoid. This is where some of the distortion comes in, if we're not really paying attention to some of the deeper motivations in our practice. So if we think that equanimity is opposite of being reactive, opposite of being lost in anger and fear, then the mind thinks that equanimity must be this sense of being detached, a sense of distance, sense of being removed from life, so it can't touch me, it can't hurt me in the same way. And so to be a good meditator, I need to be less reactive. So no matter what happens, I should be calm, I should just kind of take it in stride, this sense of being balanced. And when that doesn't happen, when our internal experience is opposite of that, then there's this tension that arises, right? This tension, I'm not being a good meditator, I'm not being Buddhist enough, I'm not being spiritual enough. There's something wrong with me. Now this tendency of trying to avoid pain, again, it's a very tender part of us. It can sound very enticing, this concept of equanimity, to find this place where I'm not touched by pain, where I'm kind of removed from it. Something bad can happen, I just say, oh, that's just life, I can just float with it. If I'm if I have equanimity, I won't be upset, I won't feel emotional, mental pain. Whatever happens, I won't be so affected by it. And then what starts to happen is we slip in an investment in being a certain way, in being a certain type of person. This is a very slippery thing that kind of comes in. It's, you know, we've trained our whole lives to be that way, to be, you know, to be a good boy, a good girl, or to be a bad boy, a bad girl, whatever our tendency is to get along in life. And so too as a meditator, oh, I need to be I need to have equanimity. Sometimes I can say that word. So it becomes a stance, a position that we need to defend, that we need to reinforce. And anything that goes contrary to that, I need to get rid of, or ignore, or suppress. I need to suppress the anger, the fear, that doesn't match this concept of being equanimous. As the saying goes, if the facts don't fit the theory, throw out the facts. Right? So that can slip in a very insidious way. The more we're invested in being a calm person, the more that tension comes up. And this is the distortion of equanimity, something that we have to be really aware of. Because it is a very fundamental instinct to move away from what hurts, what's painful, whether it's physical, whether it's mental, spiritual. There's this tendency to avoid it. And part of that is very healthy and very reliable. And part of it is very much keeps us caught in our neuroses and our reactivity. Because often we need to really very much turn toward that discomfort with compassion, with tenderness. So if we start to adopt this misconception of equanimity, I need to be this calm person no matter what, suppressing the parts which aren't calm, which aren't fitting with that, we start to harden aspects of ourselves, start to create a sense of distance internally from those parts, and then it is mirrored externally. It's mirrored in our relationships, in how we relate to other people, to other situations. We just can't hold that painful experience, that painful situation. To quote a few lines from Simon and Garfunkel, I touch no one and no one touches me. I am a rock, I am an island, and a rock feels no pain, and the island never cries. So with equanimity, we need to listen to that it's really, it's a tender part of us that wants to avoid pain, wants to escape from pain, to listen to that, and to not let that come into a way of a dysfunctional way of working with us. This very human nature, this very human tendency to try to avoid pain. Because if we're operating from that avoidance, if we're operating from that not wanting to turn toward, then we're not really being equanimous, we're being disconnected. We're being distant, disengaged. And we hear about this end of suffering, this end of our pain, and say, okay, can this be at this place of find myself removed from? And if you've practiced for a while, you can kind of slip into that place of being just connected to your breath, just coming back to the sensations in the body. And there's a sense of grounding with that. That feels very lovely, feels very stabilizing. There's a sense of feeling oriented to where you are in the world. But there's also a way that you're a little unavailable. You're a little removed, a little aloof from yourself and from others. And if you listen, when you start to talk about your practice with people, they give you feedback, especially people like your family who don't practice. They say that you're doing that Dharma speak again. And they can sense that. It's a very tangible feeling of being kind of talked down to, a sense of, if you were as calm as I would be, then this would not be a so big problem that you're having this divorce or whatever it is. All right. And hopefully our practice is mature past that, that we really don't care about being aloof, we care about this deep intimacy. There's a movie that I watch with my daughter called The Song of the Sea. It's an animated movie, but it's not like one of the new ones, which are so there's so much sensory overload. It's a very quiet, very beautiful, artistic movie. But there's a character, a witch, whose son was grieving so much from the loss, I think, of his wife. And the witch wanted to stop his pain. And the only way she knew how to do that was to turn him into stone, to take away his pain by turning him into stone. So he became this big mountain. And so then she goes through this mission. Okay, I'm going to alleviate everyone's suffering. So anyone who's having any kind of emotion, she goes through and takes that, their soul basically, and they turn into stone. Right? And she does that for herself. She starts to get angry, so she's slowly turning more and more into this block of stone. And she still has some wings, but she's kind of losing pieces of that. And it's coming from this heartfelt desire not to feel pain, not to have others feel pain. And luckily in the story, she finally realizes that this isn't the right way. And then everyone is restored to their wholeness which includes the pain of being human. So this is in some ways the danger of equanimity. When you find yourself turning into stone, to wake up, to re-examine. Because equanimity can't exclude the heart. The heart can't be outside of this quality of equanimity. And all the pain of being human, all the suffering that's inherent in having a human body, having human relationships, and all their complexity. And if there's not this natural, easy access to compassion, to metta, to sympathetic joy, if that's absent, then the equanimity is out of balance. It's probably not true equanimity. Because equanimity is one of the four Brahma Viharas, one of the four divine abodes. These are said to be the natural expression of the white awakened heart. The awakened person goes through life relating to life through loving kindness, through compassion, through sympathetic joy, and through equanimity. They're all held as equals, all held as balance. So if you only find one of these is accessible, then it needs to come more into balance. Just as with compassion, if there's a sense of being so touched and so overwhelmed by the world's events and your own pain, equanimity may be out of balance. Right? And same too, if the heart is cold, and you know, there's a kind of a crystal logic that you're going through life, you need to bring this quality of compassion, of loving kindness back in. And this statement that the Brahma Viharas all work as a unit, there are all expressions of the same essence, is a little confronting to our normal way of being, the normal way of being in the world. Challenging for that. Because so often we're used to going after what we desire, what we want, pushing away what we don't want in the world. And there's a sense of, okay, I need to get more of this, I need to get less of this. And the only way that equanimity makes sense from this way of being is to be disconnected, to be aloof. Okay, if I can't want, wanting causes pain. If pushing away causes pain, I need to go into this place of aloofness, of distance, hiding away my heart, becoming a rock or an island, turning into stone. But yet, if equanimity is the equal expression of the awakened heart as loving kindness, compassion, of sympathetic joy, then that logic doesn't make sense. This is where it starts to confront the way that we are in the world, our assumptions of the world. So we start to make a more fundamental shift to practice true equanimity, a fundamental shift in how we are in ourselves, how we view the world. This is almost like really examining this point of reference that we start from. You could almost use the analogy of a map. We look at a map, we're used to saying, okay, this is where Seattle is, this is where Tacoma is, wherever that we might live, and there's a certain orientation to that. But if we step back, the map is all oriented to north, Right? So this northward orientation, north of the top of the map, that's similar to this deep assumption of ourselves, of separation that we place on our experience. So these parameters, these deep assumptions shape the very way that we perceive life, we perceive ourselves, shapes the way we think and perceive and act. And you look at equanimity from this much broader perspective, we realize this normal perspective, this normal assumption doesn't fit, that there's something needs to be released in this. So our normal parameters include separation, a sense of self and other, a sense of a solid self, an everlasting self that's always going through this life that we need to defend, we need to enhance, we need to judge, we need to fix, need to improve. There's this fundamental questioning that equanimity starts to lead us toward. Now, the definition of equanimity that I like the most is being equally near to all things. Being equally near to all things. And I first heard Christina Feldman say this. Now, for this to be true, to be equally near all things, what must happen? What must shift in our perception, in the way we view ourselves and others? What shift of orientation, of perspective? Because it's phrased equally near all things. It's not phrased equally far away from all things. That'd be kind of easy. Okay, I'll just be a hermit and retreat, and then I'll see everyone, my pain and my joy, all from a distance. But equally near has this sense of intimacy, this inviting, this sense of closeness to experience. And so taking something like the horrific event on Sunday, you know, and taking that horror, can you be equally near to that as a beautiful day? As your breath? As this, where you're sitting right now? What would it take to be equally near to both of those? You get a sense that this sense of this self, this perspective of separation can't hold that. It can't go there. It falls apart in that question, that invitation. But to be equally near to something that's horrific and heart-wrenching and to something that's joyous at the same time, there's a loosening of these boundaries, this sense of isolation, this sense of me being separate. The good news is that you're not creating something. You're uncovering something that's always there, that's so forgotten, that's so covered over by our lives. That's why it can arise in any moment. See, the Dharma asks something very deep of us. You know, there's these very deep orientations, these deep perspectives, like the fact that the map is always oriented toward north. That's the way it always is, right? So we have to be willing to first look enough. It's right there, but it's so obvious, it's so much in our front of our face, we don't see it. Okay? We have to be willing to see it, and then to question it, and to see what is beyond that. So then it becomes a relative truth that we bring forth, but we don't see it as the absolute truth. So in this way, equanimity starts to become like a koan, where often we have to, a Zen riddle, that we can't solve through our conventional way of thinking, our conventional thought process. Our conventional assumptions won't let us solve that riddle. We have to be able to shift into the perspective that created the riddle. We have to be willing to shift and to release something very fundamental in ourselves. maybe it's trying to be, it's not about trying to become a certain person that has equanimity. It's not about becoming a certain person that has this characteristic or this personality trait of being calm no matter what's arising. Because that's, when we go into that mode, we go into the same mode of wanting, of gain and loss. And we're in this whole spectrum that's always going to be failing us if you look closely enough, if you follow it if you follow it along far enough, it will fail us. So if we start to relate to equanimity not as a characteristic that we can acquire, but more as a process, more as a sense of unfolding, meeting each moment. Because where is equanimity other than right now? Where is it other than right now? Where is there metta other than right now? Compassion other than right now? If you go into the past or the future, we've lost it. It's only right here or not at all. There's this constant process, constant quality of unfolding. There's a story of the founder of Aikido. One of his students was watching the master demonstrate technique after technique. Throughout the demonstration, Ueshiba's balance appeared perfect. The student had been observing this since the first day that he, striving unsuccessfully ever since to emulate the master's apparent perfection. At the end of class, he approached the great mass teacher and said, "Sensei, I have to ask you a question. I've been training and training for years. Every day I train, I'm out of balance. Every technique, no matter how rudimentary, I'm always off balance. I watch you train, and you're never off balance. How do you do it?" And the teacher said, No, this isn't true. I'm frequently off balance. I am just very quick to get back on balance." This is from Fearless Writing by William Kenover. So that quality of being off balance and then regaining that, that's being in the process. We could say equanimity is this line of taking a position, taking a stance in this moment's experience. I'm liking it. I'm not liking it. I want more of it. I want less of it. That's taking a position. I mean, this is a very, it's easily said, but it really, there's this whole way that we take shape around that stance, that position. So equanimity is that choice of coming that or releasing that to going into a relationship that's beyond distinction, beyond differences, beyond separation. And in that place, equanimity makes complete sense. In fact, it's the only natural way of relating to this moment's experience. So instead of trying to acquire this, I'm always going to be equanimous, it's much more the sense of how do I meet this moment, time and time again. Christina also said, we develop equanimity by withdrawing our insistence that the moment be different. That we cultivate equanimity by withdrawing our insistence that the moment be different than it is. Okay, so this moment can't be anything different than it is. This very moment, this very, you know, fraction of a second can't be any different. And so as we start to say, okay, this is how this moment is, that cultivates this quality of equanimity. Now, next time something doesn't go as planned, when your traffic is bad or your body hurts or your friend says something you wish they hadn't or your stomach hurts, whatever it might be, when it doesn't go the way you want it to, This is a chance to practice equanimity, to practice this quality of balance. But as you do that, carefully monitor, okay, am I disconnecting from this experience? Am I trying to go into this aloof, distant relationship to it that feels like I'm balanced, but really isn't? Because the heart isn't open. So of course, many times, we're not going to be possible to be equanimous with some experience. But can we be equanimous with the fact that we're not? Can we be equanimous with the fact that we're being very reactive? So I might be having a severe pain, like, remember there's a time when I had a kidney stone. I was on a retreat, actually, and I didn't know it was a kidney stone for a while, so I just was trying to sit with the pain and feel the pain and just feel all the changing sensations and the kind of trying to find a position that didn't hurt as much and all the emotionality that would come up with that. And just, you know, being with that again and again. Okay, so coming back, even though the sensation was too much to hold and I was reactive to it, I was practicing not being reactive to my reaction. Now, do you get a sense of that? It's like there's a layer, there's a hot, red hot layer I can't open to, but there's a layer of it that I can relax with. Okay, I don't want this, but I can relax with the fact that I don't want this. This is a hard experience. And this is a process of, we lose our balance all the time. We're always getting thrown off our feet. We're always becoming re-engaged, re-caught in this reactivity. It's like that kidney stone, a few months later, I had a recurrence of it. And I thought, oh, I could handle that pretty well. But when the pain came back, the pain was pretty minor. Well, it was intense, but it wasn't as bad as my fear. The fear was much worse. But I could see that. So, you know, wow, this is really, the fear just arose, but it was a part of me that was able to see the fears arising also. And say, okay, I can meet the fear at least. The sense of anticipation, of worry, of terror really, of that, those days of pain continuing. So where is there equanimity possible in this moment? Where is it possible right now? So then we start to allow life to flow through us without so much residue, without so much sticking. So each time something arises and we get reactive with it, it's a sticking quality to it. Now if you allow it to arise without it sticking, without it becoming really, the sticking is making meaning of it, making meaning about who we are in relationship to that experience. If we allow it to rise and pass through us without that meaning making, then it flows through us. Right? We're being equanimous with that experience, equally near to all things. Now, a good litmus test for equanimity, is the eight worldly winds. Now, these worldly winds, the Buddha talked about arising regardless of our actions, regardless of our intentions. And these are just a part of being alive, being human. Certainly our actions kind of predispose us to one or another having more often. But even if we're living very well, we still experience these. So eight of them are paired. There's gain and loss. There's fame and disgrace, praise and blame, and pleasure and pain. Right? This is part of being human, that we will experience these poles, these sides of things. So with equanimity, when we feel ourselves being either any time of gain or loss, there is often a position that arises with that. There's a sense of, okay, I am orienting myself in relationship to this gain or this loss. I'm creating a sense of me in relationship to it, right? Through my wanting it or not wanting it. So the first thing is to notice this fundamental position that arises. And when I say notice, it's like it's a very much a deep noticing, a deep sense of one not investing more into that position. That's a key, because if we keep investing in it, we're lost in it. It's like we're tumbling in the process instead of being able to have some perspective of seeing what's arising. Right? So seeing that position of arising in relationship to this. Okay, I really want this praise. I really want this fame. I really don't want this loss. I don't want this blame. So gain and loss. There's this story I appreciate of a Zen master and a teacup. That whenever they would get like a beautiful teacup, maybe a one of a kind teacup, this Zen master would imagine the cup already broken, already shattered. Right, and so then it was a sense of taking this cup and realizing at some point it will no longer be whole. Or no longer be intact. You know, contrast that with how you are when you get a new car or you get a new possession, how you don't want anything to happen to it. You get a new shirt and you get that first stain on it. And it's like, oh, you know. So what if you imagine that brand new thing already having started to decay and fall apart? You hold it a little differently. If you do it in the right way, there's not a sense of cynicism or a sense of distancing from it. It just, you're holding it with the lightness of it. You're appreciating it for how long it will be there, but not longer than it will be. You're able to let it release. So gain and loss. Now fame and disgrace or disrepute. You can see how especially the sense of self really likes these or doesn't like these. We really like to get the sense of, oh, everyone thinks highly of me, you know, says I'm do such a great job in whatever arena I might be in my life. And we fear that loss of that sense of, oh, they don't know what they're doing. And how much we, if you step back from the details of it, the gripping quality of the details, and really notice the position that's forming around that. Okay, so you open to that position, and then that opening to the position starts to allow equanimity to start to flow in. This is just a role that I'm taking up, and that role will fall away. This is hard with some of our most cherished roles. Our most cherished senses of who we are. You know, often as we go through our working years and come to retirement, so I have observed anyway, that there's this loss of identity. There's a loss of how you get affirmations for the good work that you do. And as you set that work aside, then who are you without that? Who are you without that? So we can get lost in that, get really buffeted by those winds. But equanimity starts to bring this balance of being able to hold these winds, that these are just changing. We're not going to an aloof, removed place from that, but a wiser place, a place that realizes this is just a condition, this is just a sense of me that's formed. And investing in that, that's what causes the pain. That's what causes that. Whether I have fame or disrepute or disgrace. Now praise and blame, I it's one of my favorite ones actually, because you know, so often you might be praised for something, like you did a really good job on that, but I hold that lightly, realize, okay, there will be blame. At some point, there'll be criticism, and at some point. Now, if I orient to just getting only praise, of course, that creates so much tension in there. Equanimity is so far away at that point. Really, the praise come, the blame come, and we're holding that in a very even place, an even quality. and finally pleasure and pain. Now, as meditators, this is kind of our bread and butter with the physicality, that we're practicing sitting still, you know, feeling our legs go to sleep and our aches in our bodies. And can I be still with that? Can I open to that sensation and not go into my reactions to it? And we start to learn by doing that, we start to see how that translates into our emotional lives and our mental lives and our relationships. That we start to be able to hold that discomfort. We develop this capacity to hold the unpleasant and not to move from reactivity. As we do that, we start to realize this actually gives me much more ease in my life if I'm not always having to be so reactive. This is equanimity starting to come in through the technique, through pleasure and pain. So these eight worldly winds, it's a nice thing to check in when you feel that, when you feel yourself being praised or blamed, when you're feeling a sense of fame or disgrace, gain or loss, pleasure and pain. Where's equanimity in this? Is it possible to call that forth? Remembering that we have to shift out of this normal sense of wanting and not wanting, that sense of trying to avoid discomfort, go toward what's to avoid pain. We have to be willing to shift into this silence, shift out of this assumption of separation. So when we're not, our minds aren't balanced, when there's a sense of we're getting charged and triggered by things, then equanimity becomes very much a practice of calling forth, where is there equanimity in this moment? Where is there a quality of balance in this moment? Other times, when the heart and mind are balanced, equanimity becomes the natural way of being in the world. So notice that. Notice when you take a walk in the woods and your mind's relaxed and your heart is at ease, and how you look out and see the trees and the birds, you see yourself walking in the woods, and there's a sense of being equally close to all things. It's not an abstract thing, it's very tangible. And letting yourself really learn and feel that, taking that in. And then gradually this would become more and more our natural state. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. I'd like to just share a few instructions about the practice and reflection for this week. So as you practice with equanimity, notice any tendency to distance and disconnect. So equanimity has a huge shadow to it. It has a huge tendency to go into disconnection, to go into a sense of aloofness. To check in with your heart is a simple way to say it. Is my heart still accessible? Is my heart still open in this experience? What quality of heart is needed to be equally near to all things? And recognize by asking that question, you may have to make some fundamental shifts of being in this how you are in this experience, how you're showing up. It's hard to find this through our normal assumptions. So you have to be willing to be still and release and be quiet and listen and then let it emerge up from that stillness. And then finally reflect on the eight worldly winds of pain, of gain, loss, fame, disgrace, praise and blame, and pleasure and pain. And how is equanimity affected by each pair? You may have areas that you're very sensitive to and ones you're less sensitive to. And just see, where's equanimity? Where's my edges in this? And if there's one that's particularly hard to find that balance of mind, balance of heart, then make that a practice. And just say, where can I find a little bit of this? Can I at least be equanimous with my reactivity? So we have some time for any comments or questions about the talk or about practice. Yes, Peter.
I appreciated your example of just some of the things like what happened in Las Vegas, and one thing that came to mind that I've heard maybe something Rodney said about this was no moment is better than any other, which to me is very challenging. Mm-hmm. Some moments much more than
right, that. Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like I've been dealing with that a lot lately, just a lot of physical, different kinds of physical pain. And, so this is helpful in terms of looking at it as a practice opportunity. But what the pain coming up, I think, just kind of the reactivity to it is, I'm getting old, I'm getting older, and this is happening because I'm getting older, and there's certainly some fear around that. It's just going to get worse. So this is helpful in seeing that.
Good, yeah. So just to summarize for the online viewers, there's a lot to that comment. Just the sense of equanimity and the exploration helps to hold some of the real nitty-gritty qualities of like the body getting different injuries and the quality of getting older and the fear of what that will lead to. And Ed Rodney talking about how every moment is inherently the same, or is there inherently, no, there's no valuation of which is better than that, right? And how that can be a difficult concept, a different way of approaching. And it is, because we don't want to throw out preferences, right? Because we have a preference. We would like to have a pain-free body. We would like to have a safe world where no one is shot or hurt, no matter what color of their skin or whatever. There's no hatred that comes from that. That's a strong preference that we may have, right? And there's also this quality that when that does happen, how do we hold, there's this capacity of heart that holds that with equanimity, right? There's all these little I must say blind alleys, but we can kind of get into this place. If I am in equanimity, then that means I don't have to act. It takes me away from the need to act, which isn't true at all. Is actually the equanimity brings this base of action, which is much more powerful and effective, because we're able to hold it, hold life, realizing that, okay, my body is hurting. There's this injustice, there's this prejudice, there's this danger. I'm able to hold it with balance, with my eyes full open, and yet I know that there's action that's needed. And that's where it gets tricky. So it's like each moment arises, can we meet that with this balance of mind that completely opens to it, completely allows it. At the same time, the paradox is, how can we act from that? And I think that kind of the crux of it is, on the one hand, it's almost impossible, or it is impossible to figure out how to do that. We're coming from this sense of identity, of sense of self that has to somehow navigate this world and hold these incredible paradoxes of complete openness and at the same time complete responsiveness, complete action. How does that happen? That doesn't make any sense. If we come from a place of stillness, in a place of complete heartedness, then they're not a conflict. Like the actions, just okay, this is clearly the action. There's not a debate. The body is moved from that. Our lives align with that. And so there's this almost this faith or this trust to surrender to that. Because usually we're so much used to being in the driver's seat of having control and saying this is how we're supposed to do things. But that comes with all these deep assumptions that we need to play with releasing and see what comes forth. And if we can bring those skills in when we need them, but not have them be so imprisoning. You're welcome. Yes, Joyce.
I wonder if you could address a little bit how to be equanimous on the pleasure side, on the upside. It seems to me on the pain side, I can understand opening my heart, but on the pleasure side, I'm not quite sure how to become equanimous with that, with something very joyful. Does it have to do with just not craving more? It seems like you could become kind of flat.
Right. Right. So the question is, how are you equanimous with joy, with the pleasure side of things, and the sense of we might become kind of flat to it, not really opening to it, you know? Because the pain side of it seems okay, it makes sense to open to that and to allow it to flow through. If you look at the pain side for a second, what often happens is something arises that has charge, whether it's physical, emotional, mental, whatever it might be. And part of the charge is the meaning we put on it. You know, that sense of, okay, this means something about me, about you, a sense of personalization that happens with that. And the more we can just feel that emotion very directly, or that sensation very directly, it's able to flow through us, right? As long as our mindfulness is balanced. Now you look at something that's pleasurable, let's say it's a pleasurable experience, a sense pleasure. So as this arises, it's the same quality. The more sticky we get around it, the more meaning we make about this, like, oh, well, I really deserve this, or I'm really happy that I got this, and that kind of commentary that comes on, that's starting to bias us toward it. If, on the other hand, if we can almost quiet that, or it's really not so much quieting, but more shifting our focus from the commentary to the actual experience. So the commentary goes into the background. Trying to push that away doesn't work very well. You're just making secondary commentary on the commentary. But if you can go really, okay, let me fully experience this sense of pleasure. Can I allow myself to feel it completely undefended? That's actually kind of hard sometimes, to really let that beauty in, to let that pleasure in through our system. And so whether we're just meeting it without a sense of agenda, without a sense of stickiness, we'll know when that ends. When there's a sense, oh, I wish that would keep going, or that's too soon, or it's going on too long, or I don't deserve this. You know, then it's, okay, the equanimity isn't quite balanced at that point. And so I would encourage you to practice that with easy things that don't have a lot of charge. Something that, like seeing like a hummingbird come by, you can just watch that hummingbird, and you say, okay, can I just release any thoughts about it, and just be fully open to this experience. You know, feel the joy of that. And when the hummingbird goes, which it will soon, okay, then it's gone. It's like a soap bubble that's vanished. Right? So I think equanimity is learned, again, not by us trying to arbitrarily or artificially induce it, but how we meet each experience. So we meet it really with the tools of mindfulness, awareness, and investigation. So we see something arise and there's that, oh, I want that to continue. If we're able to observe that and notice that tendency, that's all that's needed. Because we're practicing being equanimous with that tendency, with that wanting to open to it. Doing that again and again starts to loosen it directly. Because it's important to realize that it's almost like a done deal when some experience arises, how you're going to react to it. Because of our past conditioning, our past history. Right? So we could have, I could show, have a slideshow or different characters walk through this room, and each one of us would have a different reaction to it that's pre-programmed based on our experience. Okay, so some of us will say, I really like that, or some are going to have a very opposite experience to that. But that's pre-programmed. But what's not pre-programmed is how do we go from there, from that first moment of, okay, I like it or I don't like it, how we respond there. That is, it's within our control. That's where our practice comes in. And the more we come to that skillfully, we start to transform what naturally starts to arise. In other words, if I practice being very attentive and not going more and more to reactivity with a difficult experience or a pleasant experience, I'm more likely to be able to be that way in the future. Vice versa, if I'm always reactive, if I get really wanting more of that, the ice cream cone, it's going to predispose me to have more of that. We're conditioning ourselves, or unconditioning ourselves. Does that make sense? Yes.
I'm getting the feeling you're kind of saying to experience it, but to let it flow through, just like paint.
Yes. Yes. So this, the short answer is to let it, yeah, to experience it and let it flow through. Yeah, to let it flow through. How much can I open to this? Yeah. Yes.
Just a comment rather than a question, because with the pleasure thing, I of course always want more too.
Right.
Not struggled with that, but contemplated that for some time. And oddly enough, the poet William Blake often comes up with these really dharmic insights. And his dharmic insight on that one, joy and let it fly. Hmm. And I always have this image of really catching a bird and holding its beauty and watching it fly.
Ah, nice.
That one is worth it.
So just to share that for the recording, that William Blake said, to catch the joy and let it fly has been a very helpful image to hold, you know, with that sense of wanting pleasure and that sense of leaning into it and how to you know, contemplate that, you know, and that's beautiful. Yeah, I think poetry is a lovely way to see that. Yeah. Is there a hand over there? Nope, just a scratching. It's like we're in an auction. Okay, $10,000, you got it. Yes, sir. Yes.
Look at the photos and put them into an album and like share them with people who weren't there and tell the story. And I keep telling myself the story over and over of what it was. But I find that it's not even the same experience. Like you said, that moment has come and it's gone. And I was fully present for that. But every time I try to go back and attach to this idea of my wedding and replay these little moments, it's not reality. It's like I'm clinging to the idea of it rather than the actual beauty of the thing that has already passed. And I catch myself doing that, and the moment that I catch myself, I just automatically let go and say, oh, it's over and that's okay. This is how it is now. Can this be okay?
Mm.
And that's really helped me like notice that on the pleasure side, like I want to relive it, but I can't. I have to just let it go and see the beauty of what was.
Nice, yeah, that's a nice sharing. So being recently married and just the joy, the, you know, the, one of the best times of his life, and going back and reliving it, connecting with the images of that through the photos and sharing the story, and seeing the tendency to want to go back to recreate that, and the wisdom of realizing, okay, that's, you know, that moment was beautiful, it was lovely, and now it's no longer here. Yeah, it's an interesting just observation, because there's a point of it where it's really healthy to share that joy, to share, because people want to celebrate, you know, two people coming together in love and this deep commitment, and it's really healthy for the relationship to remind yourselves of that, you know, and to do that. And at the same time, you notice too that, okay, there's something here that feels a little off in a small way. Yeah, you know, if you're doing this, you know, every day for the next 10 years, then that would be more. Yeah, I've seen those pictures already. But it's fine to enjoy it too. You know, you have a past to, you know, to enjoy that. You know, it's a fleeting experience. Unfortunately, we can't, you know, be in that celebration of having so many people come around us and support us. It's such a wonderful experience. So it's fine to cherish that too. You know, and at the same time, just notice I'm trying to say, don't judge that too much. Just, you know, notice that was a lovely experience, and my heart feels really warm in that. And in that way, you're connecting with the warmth of heart in the present moment. Does that make sense? As long as you keep coming back, like, this, my heart really feels warm relating this experience, connecting with my spouse, all these qualities, then it's in the present moment. When it starts to go like, you know, when you have your first fight and you're like, I wish we could go back there. Okay, that's more of that edge to look at. So thank you for sharing that. All right, probably have time for one or two more. Anything else, or is that enough? Yes.
With that, suppose you had a strong physical pain, and this might be pretty difficult to hold it lightly, maybe that's when it's the time to act.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, with pains of aging, for example, some pains you can't do a lot about, or you can't do a lot about them right then.
Right.
And, it seems to me it would be very tempting to detach.
Yes. Yeah, so the comment is on physical pain, you know, especially chronic pain or pain of aging that has this sense of glimpsing into the future. Being a quantumist can be really difficult. And I think it can be very unhelpful for someone to say, oh, just be a quantumist with that pain. You know, just relax with it and be, you know, just open to it. And that's often from someone who maybe not have much pain themselves, right? And if you have a lot of pain, you really respect it much more. Respect the intensity of it, the charge of it, just the exhaustion from that pain. And so that sense of wise distraction, wise disengagement can be very helpful. Because it's, you know, again, we're picking up this one word, equanimity, But the Dharma doesn't travel alone. There's these all these other components. There's loving kindness, there's compassion, there's mindfulness. They have to, also come along. And so mindfulness has this quality of complete meeting whatever is here, completely meshes with it. Something that's charged and painful, the mindfulness often can't do that because it's so charged. So I think it's very helpful to learn to go to something else in the moment that is pleasant, that is at least neutral, that the mindfulness can start to balance around. Practice the equanimity there, and then come back, kind of titrate, go back and forth with the difficult. But whenever you feel like, I should be equanimous with this, I should have more equanimity, that should, the should tip you off that you're going the wrong direction. You're kind of forcing yourself to be something that you're not. Yeah. And that's why this word is a little tricky. I think we have to be very careful with how we take that on, because I think a lot of distortion comes from that. Yes. Right.
And so trying to find the balance between, to shut it off, whether it could be a good experience, have some good effects of it, because I'm thinking, oh, it must be bad, or it's going to, just bring up emotional things, versus just wipe up and do that and do it anyway. That also seems really harsh, I guess that is finding the equanimity between those two extremes.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes. The comment or question is on just a decision about whether to go back to a country where there's a lot of trauma, a lot of pain there, and whether it's kind of wise to go back there, is it knuckling through it to force that sense of forcing through that. So I think it's important to realize the Dharma isn't really designed to solve problems, but more to give you the tools to see more clearly. So to really sense, to feel kind of both those edges of what it feels like to white knuckle and to kind of power yourself through that. And, there's a sense of empowerment with that. There's a sense of, okay, I can do this. And there's also that sense of, the other hand, really respecting the tenderness of the situation. I mean, a good rule of thumb, I think, is to notice what your default is, what your more natural way to do is, and there's going to be more learning doing opposite of that. You're going to learn much more. Like for myself, I tend to be more stoic. I mean, I can power through a lot of stuff, but to be willing to actually say, no, I'm going to take care of myself. I'm going to respect that. It's actually a lot more growth happens with that. It brings up much more stuff to notice. And then my heart starts to soften, and I have much more of a sense of discernment, going back to that essential question. Is this really coming from a sense of should, a sense of having to, or is this coming from a more of a heartfelt? And so it's a quandary, but sitting with it and feeling, taking time to say, this day I'm going to go, and just feel what it is like in the body. And the next day say, okay, I'm going to not go, and feel what that is in the body. And you start to trust the resonance, because there's a deep resonance in there. That still, quiet voice is there if you listen for that. It's going to just say, one way or another, and then see what happens.
Yeah, I think also kind of allowing both those voices you're describing.
Yeah.
It's more about seeing the relationship to the...
Yes. Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, so the secondary comment is seeing both voices. You see them really as you, that's what's trying to bring equanimity to the picture. That's why you asked that, because you're seeing both voices as equally have their own validity to them, and also their equal invalidity. As Rodney said, all thoughts are equally valid. Or he could also say, all thoughts are equally invalid. You know, so, and that's that quality of mind that's able to hold both of these opposing things is a capacity of equanimity. Good. Thank you for sharing that. All right, we need to stop for announcements, so thank you for your kind attention, and just stay for a few more minutes while Peter comes up.